Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Today it's become increasingly apparent that childhood trauma is a major contributor to a child's readiness to learn as well as their behavior in the classroom. Numerous studies have shown that children exposed to trauma ranging from domestic and physical abuse to neglect, hunger, or neighborhood violence demonstrate significant cognitive and memory function deficits, attention issues, and behavioral outbursts that can affect their ability to learn as well as a teacher's ability to teach. One researcher said, "What's an educator to do? Well, first, here's what not to do. Punish a child for showing symptoms of a medical disorder." My guest today has more than 20 years' experience in child care, kindergarten, and elementary teaching, and today teaches parents, child welfare agencies, schools, and child care centers on the effects of trauma on children. Dr. Barbara Sorrells is a director of the Institute for Childhood Education and the founder of Connected Kids, which helps institutions create trauma-responsive classrooms with an aim of building trauma-responsive communities. She's the author of Reaching and Teaching Children Exposed to Trauma, and this summer and fall, Connected Kids will be offering intensive workshops to train teachers, caregivers, and others on child development techniques and strategies to reach and teach children affected by trauma. She joins us today here on Studio Tulsa. Barbara Sorrells, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you for the opportunity.
You describe a lot of childhood behavior that nearly every parent will witness in their child's peer groups, in their social settings, educational settings, preschool biting, for example, or defiant behavior, bullying, all sorts of experience that you write about in the book. In the book, you say a lot of these have trauma at the root of the behavior. How often is it the case that trauma is at the root?
Well, I would say certainly that children, all children engage in some sort of challenging behavior from time to time, but we consider it in a sense a challenge when it disrupts the child's capacity to enjoy relationships, to enjoy learning and play. Now, I would say that when you see persistent challenging behavior, it always stems from an unmet need. And I think when you understand trauma from a much broader perspective, you realize that it's not just about abuse and neglect, but those fundamental needs of children have somehow not been met when you see it disrupt daily living.
When you're saying an unmet need, what do you mean? Hunger?
Well, certainly some of those fundamental needs that all children have for sufficient nutrition, adequate sleep, movement. Movement is critical for brain development. And these days, we're seeing more and more children parked in front of screens where their bodies are not getting that movement that they need, literally for their brain to develop in healthy sorts of ways. But also, it could be a lack of attention. We live in a preoccupied culture. Not only are children preoccupied with screens, but also parents are. And that one-on-one interaction, that face-to-face contact, that invested parenting that may not be happening in a home, I would consider that an unmet need.
That may be an unmet need, but does that raise to the level of trauma? Or would it require extreme lack of, stimulation or one-to-one conversation with parents or neglect goes to that level?
Well, certainly there's a continuum of neglect.
So let's talk about trauma. What is the range of issues that can cause it?
Well, when we think about trauma, obviously we think about the grosser kinds of situations like abuse and neglect and domestic violence. Most people are very surprised to learn that domestic violence is one of the most disruptive forms of trauma.
So even if it's not directed towards the child, witnessing the behavior.
Absolutely. Because that child has no control, and really domestic violence robs that child of both parents. You have the abusive parent, and then you have the parent who's the victim of the abuse, who's preoccupied with their own safety. And in a sense, I lose that parent as well because that parent is no longer able to parent me well. But then there are also other forms of trauma that we don't think about, being born prematurely and immediately put into the NICU. Instead of being placed into the arms of mom, I'm put into a situation where I'm prodded and poked and IV lines put in my body. And from the child's perspective, that baby doesn't understand that you're doing this to save my life. All I know is I'm being harmed at the hands of an individual. And really what's happening there is that early insult is disrupting the development of the regulatory system of the brain. So being born prematurely, early medical trauma, having some kind of invasive surgery in the first 3 years of life before language comes online is viewed from the child's perspective of being traumatic because they don't have the language to understand what's happening to them. So trauma has a much broader definition than we often think.
When we think of unsafe neighborhoods, things
yes.
like that,
yes.
can that be
yes.
one as well?
Yes. Certainly living in a neighborhood where there's violence, one of the things we know is the brain hates unpredictability. And I have no control over when violence is going to break out in my neighborhood, and living with that constant threat of, is there going to be a drive-by shooting? Am I going to be safe when I walk down the street? Is very scary to young children. And really, it impacts that child's development at a very fundamental biological level and disrupts that healthy development.
You're always on alert.
Exactly.
Your body is producing chemicals that keep you at a high state of alert, that your eyesight is keener, you're looking for threats.
Exactly.
Yeah. What about things like poverty and things like that, just the endemic poverty of not having enough to eat on a regular basis? You mentioned sleep as just, mm-hmm. Disrupted sleep.
Mm-hmm. Certainly when those fundamental needs of the body are not met, that food scarcity, constantly living with that chronic fear that there's not going to be enough, is very frightening to a young child. And then, of course, the lack of sleep. I mean, I have talked to principals where they say they know that there's one mattress in the house and children take turns at night. A few of them get on the mattress while the rest are on the floor, and somewhere in the night they switch. And that certainly doesn't provide that child with the sleep that he needs. And we know that sleep is absolutely fundamental to healthy brain development.
Hmm. Now, one of the pieces of your work is connecting how trauma can affect brain development and a child's ability to learn. Can you give us some insight there?
Certainly. We actually know that the younger the child is when they experience trauma, that the greater the impact on the brain. The first 3 years of life is when that baby is most vulnerable to the insult of trauma. So, for example, when I live with very high levels of cortisol in my body, it impacts the hippocampus, which is the part of the brain that is responsible for memory. And so children who live with chronic threat often have difficulty with short-term memory. So obviously I'm sitting in a classroom and I'm expected to remember massive amounts of information or to remember a three-part direction. A teacher may say, Johnny, get your backpack and your jacket and your lunchbox and go stand by the door to go home. And you look over and Johnny's got his jacket, but no lunchbox, no backpack. And you think Johnny's not listening when it could be that Johnny can't remember three things in a row.
Wow. And so how do you tell teachers to identify that and, make sense of that?
Well, I think that's the challenge right now, because we are seeing more and more children who are struggling in the classroom. We have unprecedented levels of four-year-olds getting kicked out of preschool programs, childcare centers all across our nation, because literally they're throwing chairs and tipping over tables. And I think for teachers to understand the behavior, you have to be grounded in child development and neuroscience. And I think the solutions begin with the why. Why are they doing this? And I think when we understand those fundamental processes of development and what happens at a very biological level to children who live in these conditions, then I can have that understanding where I no longer look at you and say, what in the world is wrong with you, kid, to what has happened to you? And it helps teachers to look at these children with compassion versus irritation and realize that these kids don't lay awake at night thinking of ways to get on your last nerve. They're simply reacting and responding out of their perception and experience of the world.
Now, you started out as a teacher, correct?
Yes.
Uh-huh. So tell me about your own experience where you began witnessing this behavior and when you put two and two together and realize this is not this child trying to get on my nerves, but it's something that's happened to that child.
Well, actually, my journey started way back in the 60s when I was 14 years old. I grew up in the Washington, D.C. area, and on Sunday afternoons, I used to rock abandoned babies at D.C. General Hospital. Mm. And even as a 14-year-old, I realized that these babies were profoundly different. They never laughed. They never cried. It was eerily silent in this room. And I wanted to know why. I think one of the reasons I did go into early childhood is I am the perpetual four-year-old, and I believe finding the solution to any problem begins with the why. And so as time went on, my very first job was in the inner city in D.C. I saw children who had behaviors that I could not make sense of, and I realized I had no tools I had children throwing chairs. I had children falling out and rolling on the floor and throwing their shoes. The only thing I knew is that these young children had seen more violence in their four short years than most of us will ever see in a lifetime. And again, that question of why? Why and how has this so fundamentally changed them? Fast forward a few more years, I'm still in the classroom in the late 70s, early 80s, and that's when kids started showing up with the bottle of Ritalin. And we had never seen this before. Never talked about it in college. Everybody's scratching their heads, going, what's happened to the kids? And one of the things that I am adamant about is that you document, you notice, because over time, a pattern will emerge when you're trying to figure out what's going on with a child. And I learned to ask three questions. Has this child been through a divorce? Whenever I saw the bottle of Ritalin, that was my number one go-to question. And I would say 90% of the time, that child had experienced a divorce. The next question that I learned to ask was, has this child been adopted? I had no idea why that made sense. Now we know. We have rocket science to help us understand why children who are adopted have a much greater likelihood of being diagnosed with ADD, ADHD.
Is that just a part of the attachment process in early age?
And yeah. Also some of the stress that happens in pregnancy. You know, children are adopted for a reason. They are handed over to someone else for a reason. And often that very process of deciding and all of the events that lead up to that can be very stressful for the mom, which in turn is stressful for the baby. So there's this dynamic that we now understand that we didn't back in the 70s and 80s. And then the last question I asked, has this child seen trauma? And I would say 5% of the time back in that time frame, that child had had some kind of adversity. For example, I had a child that was suicidal in first grade. And when I was talking to mom, she said, Dad was a policeman. And when Dad got mad, he fired guns into the ceiling. That's traumatic. And wow. So again, I'm reading everything I can get my hands on. Can't find anybody with answers. And then 1998, I met a man by the name of Dr. Bruce Perry at a conference. And he began to describe what happens to children at a very biological level, how trauma changes us from the inside out.
It changes the brain, right?
The brain, yeah. And all the biological systems. And, you know, I'll never forget that day. I was like, alas, after these decades of trying to figure it out, here's somebody that has answers. So he has had a huge impact, and I've had the opportunity to train with him and his colleagues, and another person has had a huge impact on me in terms of how I interact and understand children is Dr. Karen Purvis. She was at the Texas Christian University, unfortunately passed away 3 years mm-hmm. ago. But her work was very much about how trauma changes the neurochemistry of children's brains.
My guest today is Dr. Barbara Sorrell. So she is the founder of Connected Kids and the director of the Institute for Childhood Education, which she also founded, and the author of Reaching and Teaching Children Exposed to Trauma. And Connected Kids is trying to build a trauma-responsive community, and they'll be offering a series of workshops for preschool and elementary-level educators this summer and again this fall for teachers to help understand these processes that you're talking about that you've learned the hard way in your classroom. And she's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. We were talking about things like adoption and divorce. Boy, that's mm-hmm. probably touching some mm-hmm. really hot buttons there. And oftentimes we're told that, well, don't worry, children are resilient. And I was struck by something you said. You know, we hear that all the time. So the thing we need to keep in mind is children are malleable and they can learn resilience, but they're not certainly born with resilience. Can you elaborate on that?
I think that is one of the greatest myths of our culture. And I think what it leads to is just saying, well, it doesn't matter. All kids are resilient. But exactly as you said, all children are born malleable. We know that the brain basically comes into this world with the capacity to be customized. But resilience is a very different thing. Resilience means that I have the internal and external resources to overcome whatever adversity is thrown at me. And the number one resource that most children or that all children need is a relationship with an invested caregiver. And I would dare say that in our culture, that most of our children are at risk of relational poverty. Those nurturing, invested, supportive relationships where I'm committed to you, I believe in you, not every child has. And that's the key for a child to become resilient.
Yeah, I think of resilience as being, you know, you fall down, you dust yourself off and just move on like nothing's mm-hmm. happened. Well, most of the time when a kid does that, they're going to cry for a little bit. And, you know, a caregiver or somebody who loves them is going to pat them and hug them and say, you're all right. And then they go back out and play.
Exactly.
You know? I mean, and that's very simplified, but isn't that the same process you're talking about?
Exactly. Because if that child falls down time after time, as all kids do in childhood, and encounter those everyday normal childhood minor challenges, manageable challenges, I would say, and there is no one there to comfort. There is no one there to give that child a hug. Or you have the parent who says, well, big boys don't cry. You're going to cry. I'll give you something to cry about. There is no invested caregiver. Then that child begins to approach the world as if the world is a shark tank or I'm a lonely island that has to take care of myself. Their entire view of the world changes in how they approach it.
I was struck by something you were saying earlier about that first time as a 14-year-old working with abandoned babies in Washington, D.C., and you said it was the eeriest, quiet room mm-hmm. you'd ever heard. And I was struck by something as you were talking about the levels of calm, which calm is the best state for a child to be in to learn. Mm-hmm. And then there's alert. And then you'll have to go through the whole, but at the very top level, it's sort of almost a freeze view in which they're just taking in the world. They're not doing anything because they're at a very high state of chemical alertness and fear.
Exactly. Dr. Perry has identified what he calls the five arousal states. And we know that children are at their best when I'm in that state of calm. I can access my full functional IQ. I can be creative and reflective. But then something happens, and we know that novelty, transitions, and trauma automatically bump children up into a higher arousal level. So I have a spelling test, and we've all had that experience of knowing that we did study for this, and you get in there in the test, and it's as if you had never studied at all and you can't remember. That's because you have gone into a higher arousal state. Now, with typically developing children, they kind of vacillate back and forth between calm and alert as they sit in a classroom or presented with new information. But you have that child who lives in a hyper-aroused state, who lives with trauma, who comes from that domestic violence household. They may be living on a moment-to-moment basis in what Dr. Perry identifies as that alarm state. That is their baseline. That's their best self.
And that's above alert. Alert is
exactly.
Alarm is the next stage,
exactly.
Right?
You have that calm, that alert, that alarm, fear, and terror. And so that child who lives in that state of alarm, something happens. You know, a teacher may simply tell him to pick up a piece of paper. And he reacts in a very aggressive manner because what he hears, because of where he lives and his view of the world and his fragile image of self, what you're saying is you're stupid. They completely misinterpret some of those very simple messages that we give that a well-nurtured child would simply reach over and pick up the paper, but now I've got this power struggle going on. And then those kids who actually move into that state of terror, literally there's no thinking. I am just reacting out of body memory. There's no intentional processing that goes on. I simply react.
And then in extreme cases, they just shut down, right?
Exactly. Or I freeze. Yeah. We typically think of children who are stressed out as being very much, in a sense, what we call acting out. But really, there are many that just simply shut down. They may be staring at you, looking at you, and you think they're processing, but they are gone. They are checked out.
Now, your work is in helping educators and caregivers recognize these levels and recognize trauma. And then creating a trauma-responsive education. What does that look like? How does that work?
Well, I think that the traditional ways of schooling are no longer working because we are seeing more and more children who are experiencing adversity at home. So behavior is different. We use that term that children act out. They are indeed acting out what they don't have words to express. So it changes our paradigm in how we look at behavior. Behavior is a form of communication. And if I don't understand some basic principles of child development and neuroscience, I don't know how to interpret that behavior. Now, historically, we use very behaviorist methods such as reward and punishment to supposedly attach negative consequences to behaviors that we want to extinguish. That no longer works when we're dealing with children who have trauma. And so we have to approach it very differently, and we understand how the brain develops new pathways, how the brain learns new behaviors. We now know that they learn new behavior the very same way they learn a new skill. We would never tell a child who was trying to learn their times tables and messed up to go sit in timeout and think about it. But that's exactly what we do
for behavior.
We assume they're doing it on purpose, and we assume that they do know the appropriate way to behave, and that is not the case. And so, for example, instead of sending children to timeout, in our approach, we use do-overs or a reboot or a redo, whatever you want to call it. And basically what we do is we walk that child through that behavior again. We might say something, you know, hey, bud, that's not okay. Let's try that again and ask for that toy in a respectful manner, or ask to borrow a pencil in a respectful manner, not just grab it out of their hands. But this is what it looks like. This is what you say.
You're actually modeling the behavior.
Exactly. You model the behavior. Then you actually, in that moment, have the child do that. Say, may I please borrow a pencil? Now let's try that. And when I do that time after time, I'm building new connections and new pathways in that brain. Now, creating environments that heal versus simply managing behavior is a longer journey. It takes longer to simply build those pathways. But what we're doing is we're changing the brain from the inside out, because most likely when all I do is this external management, as soon as that child walks out of that classroom, he's going to go back to doing things as he did before.
I was wondering, how effective is this when you have, a caregiver in early preschool education? You know, they may see them for a long period of time during the day, but, you know, every night they go home, every weekend they're home. And then the next year, they have a different caregiver. Same in school. You know, most of the time you have an elementary school, you're there for one grade, you move on to the next. How big a difference can you make in a course of 9 months, or even in a preschool where it may be 10 or 11 months?
Well, to be honest, I would not be doing what I do if I did not believe that we can make substantial change. Now, of course, it would always be better and more beneficial and probably faster if we had parents on board. But the fact that we see children for 6-7 hours a day means that we can truly make some progress in helping that child to understand. And children do have some degree of capacity to compartmentalize. They know that in this context, this is the way I do things. In this context, this is how things operate. But I also think that it says some things to schools in terms of traditional education. I'm a big advocate of looping, which means that teacher may start out in first grade with a group of children, then the next year she goes up, or multi-age classrooms. And that's one of the things that I think schools need to be looking at, is how can we maintain the continuity of relationship, because that is so critical.
That's putting a huge burden on your teachers and caregivers. I mean, beyond what they're doing now. And for teachers, it's, you know, you have a series of high expectations that the school is placing on them for intellectual achievement and educational achievement in addition to this.
That's
a tall order for one person who's in a classroom of 25. And if you have 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 kids that are in this, boy, that's almost impossible, so would think.
You're exactly right. that is one of the big questions that we have to address. When you have 7 chair throwers and table tippers in a room with one teacher, it is impossible. And that's one of the questions that I've been putting forward to schools, is that the time has come. We have hit a wall hard enough. Oklahoma has the highest rates of childhood adversity in the nation, which I look at as the greatest opportunity to make a difference and to find some answers. And that is, in a sense, what we did over the last 2 years as a grassroots effort. We created what we call the intensive care classroom, where we took 10 preschoolers who were experiencing major challenges. For example, we had one little guy that was kicked out of 4 programs who came to us. We had 10 children with 3 teachers, to help give the relational density. Because one of the things that we know is children who have significant adversity, these chair throwers and table tippers, they need the same density of touch and relationship as an infant. And so we've got to figure out, as a community, it's way bigger than just the school system. Because what's going on now in our schools is going to impact the community at large. It is a tall order for teachers. And we need to be giving teachers support, coming alongside teachers, giving them the same level of care and nurture that we expect them to give children.
Well, let me ask you about Connected Kids, this summer intensive, and then I guess you'll have a fall intensive as well on evening and weekends. What are some of the skills you're teaching teachers and caregivers?
Well, one of the things that we are will be working on is embedding more rhythm and movement in the classroom. Dr. Perry's research has shown us that rhythm actually helps to organize the brain and regulate the central nervous system. And so how do we get children involved in more rhythmic activity, more movement? Typically in traditional education, the model is sit down, be quiet. We have this notion that learning only happens when children are still and quiet. That is not true. Brain research has completely blown that one out of the water. So how do we embed more rhythm? How do we embed more movement? How do we use curriculum to link children to self? Because trauma is essentially a loss of self. You know, when my needs are not met, basically what that communicates to me is you're not worth it. When I don't take children's interests seriously, it basically says to that child, you don't matter. So how can we take the curriculum that we have and tweak it just a bit to truly help children to begin to make those connections to self? How can we create relational density within our schools? I think there are some things that we can do. We do this process called nurture groups, where it's all about building community. It's all about building empathy among ourselves. How do we bring that into to our day and make that a regular part of the classroom that we do? So we'll be looking at school as it is now and how we can tweak it to bring some of these other elements in that we know will truly help children heal and become better learners.
I was struck by one technique that you write about quite a bit, and that's the technique of touch. You know, we think of parents, it's absolutely critical. It's how, it's one of those essential ways we communicate with our child, tell them they're loved, tell them they're needed, they're wanted, they belong. And yet teachers and caregivers these days are told not to touch because of, you know, sexual assault issues. It's inappropriate behavior. Touching is inappropriate behavior. Yet you write, this is one of the ways you gain a connection with some of these children that are suffering from trauma.
Absolutely. Touch is really the first language that the baby understands and is one of the fundamental ways that we do communicate caring. And when we deny children touch, it is such a fundamental need that we literally make it more likely that they're going to fall prey to people who don't have their well-being at heart because it's such a fundamental need. And so obviously we have to have care and use good judgment. For example, in our program, as children walk in the morning, we never touch without permission. And we say, hey, bud, hug, high five, handshake, or fist bump. We give them a choice. And so we find small ways, because sometimes children are very adverse to touch. And we never touch without permission, but often they'll give us a high five. And also we embed through our day lots of what we call accidental touch. We play games where we're holding hands and moving in a circle with older children. We may do some things with a parachute where we're literally bumping up against each other. When you watch children play, they do these hand clapping rhythms and Miss Mary Mac and such. Yeah. That's playful touch. And it's often we introduce the concept of touch to those children who are very adverse through these playful things. And then a form of play that we often discourage is rough and tumble play with boys. Boys play like puppies. And we have often discouraged that when we know that that's a very healthy form of play. Now, I have to monitor and teach them the difference between that playful interaction versus when someone crosses the line and actually gets angry, and to read the body language. And when someone says stop, you stop. But it is a form of play that's very necessary for children.
Dr. Barbara Sorrells is the founder of Connected Kids and the author of Reaching and Teaching Children Exposed to Trauma. Connected Kids is hoping to build a trauma-responsive community in Tulsa, and they'll be offering a series of intensive workshops for preschool and elementary educators this summer. Those sessions take place July 15th through the 19th and the 22nd through the 26th. You can learn more at connectedkids.org. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.